What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Eric Alper. From 1998 until 2016, Alper was the Director of Media Relations for E1 Music Canada, working with Bob Geldof, Matt Dusk, Randy Bachman, Ringo Starr, Slash, The Wiggles, Snoop Dogg, Ray Charles, Sinead O'Connor, and hundreds more. He started his own PR company in 2016. He has appeared as a music correspondent on numerous Canadian television and radio networks, including CBC Radio 2 and Sirius XM. I spoke with him for a little over an hour. We discuss meeting and working with Ringo Starr. We also discuss several other members of music history, such as Randy Bachman and Ray Charles. It was such a pleasure speaking with him, and I think you'll enjoy. And now I give you Eric Alper. I am here with Eric Alper. Eric, thanks for coming on the podcast.
No, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm really excited to be talking with you.
Whereabouts are you? Are you allowed to reveal what city you're in?
I'm in Minnesota.
We were in Minneapolis when Prince died.
Oh, no kidding.
We were literally at the airport about a half hour away from coming home. And normally when something big in music happens, my phone starts to blow up, and not because of my or any personal relationship that I have sometimes with some of these artists, but I get to talk about them in the media and kind of pay tribute to them and just, you know, talk about their careers and stuff like that whenever they're looking for a music correspondent. And we sat there in the airport for about 8 hours. We missed the flight on purpose. And my daughter and I were just sitting at the airport, cross-legged, going coast to coast with media interviews. And it was eerie to be there in the city when he passed away, because I think if I would have been able to walk out and walk back in again, I probably would have headed straight for Paisley Park, like I think a lot of people did that day.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He was an icon, no question. That's amazing. I don't want to jump the shark too early on here, Eric.
Oh, you already did by having me on. I mean, you're now like
the rest of the beginning.
Yeah, no. That sound is everybody just shutting it off, going, yeah, I don't need to listen to this guy anymore.
And mute. I'm really eager to discuss your brushes with history here, Eric. You know, Ringo Starr, Ray Charles, just to name a few. Before we get into everything, why don't you tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you kind of who you are and what you're doing now?
Yeah, I'm a music industry publicist. I'm sometimes known as the guy that tweets a lot. I've been doing publicity for 26 years now. It's really the only real job that I've ever had. It's the only real job I've ever wanted. And yeah, so when I mean, I've always loved music, but I could never play. And I had my own radio show and worked at the campus newspaper in university. But even before then, I had a subscription to Billboard magazine when I was 12 years old. And I just loved reading the stories of the people who worked at record labels, distributors, managers, why certain songs were breaking and others weren't, the meaning behind the song. Ever since I was a kid and I saw American Hot Wax when I was 8 years old, there was a movie that told the story of the DJ Alan Freed. And it had the real life Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis culminating in a concert. And they were performing the concert for Alan Freed. And at 8 years old, Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry were like creatures from another planet to me. I had no idea who they were. I grew up in a world before then of Donny Osmond and Sean Cassidy and reading my older sister's 16 magazine and Teen Beat. And I see these two cats on the screen and I was forever changed. That was it. I want to be part of that world of radio and rock and roll. And I had no idea how to do it. And slowly by reading Billboard every week, getting it in the mail, it was like my Bible. It was everything to me. And so when I started my record label, then a booking agent, then a publicity company. I dropped everything about a year after and just started a publicity company. That's when kind of my life ended up being more or less what it is now, with just working with all sorts of different artists, everybody from Gwar to Duran Duran to Sesame Street to, you know, Ray Charles and Jerry Lee Lewis and all, so many people that I ended up working with that I bought their records. I saw them in concert as a kid and as a teenager. So yeah, as they say, living the dream and taking bath showers so I can get to work right away.
Oh, that's awesome, Eric. Thank you so much. Yeah, and maybe just putting a little structure kind of behind that. So from 1998 until, if my info is right, 2016, you were the director of media relations for E1 Music Canada. And it was here, I think, you got to see some of music's real historical figures, right? So yeah, one doesn't get quite more historical than a Beatle, or also, you know, Randy Bachman, Bachman Turner Overdrive, of course. I'd love to know, what were your day-to-day responsibilities like there?
I was working for a small record label before I started at Koch, and then they got bought out by Entertainment One. And that record label called Shoreline Records had three artists. They had the Nylons, which was a acapella band of huge note in Canada. Patricia Conroy, who was a country artist who went on to another side of fame and fortune, writing songs and various hits on the country chart. And Nickelback's first EP, when they were pretty unknown. And we changed distributors from another company to Koch. And at the time, distributors' only job was really to bring CDs and cassette tapes from the warehouse to the record store. They were a distributor. There was nothing glamorous about it. There's nothing sexy working for a distributor. But the president of the Canadian division had a real good foresight to hire somebody, and that somebody was me. Not that he had a foresight to hire me, but he had a great idea that because all of their labels were American or UK based, and Canada was worth about 4% of the world market to them at the time. So we just got like their CDs and 8x10s and bios through email, and they just left me alone. They were like, here you go. You know, if the artist goes out on tour, just work them. And so it was there where instead of working three artists, I ended up working probably close to, oh wow, probably about 5,000, 6,000 artists over the course of that lifetime there, because they distributed artists that were on Smithsonian Folkways. So that meant Woody Guthrie, Putumayo World Music. So that was Habib Cote, Compass Records, and then the Koch record label, which had Ringo Starr and Bob Geldof and Sinead O'Connor, among others, but, you know, working a lot of hard rock and metal stuff from Relapse Records to Hopeless Records and Metal Blade and all of these amazing labels. So my day to day was like, I had no idea what I was going to be doing by 9 o'clock in the morning until I got there, because I could be working Gwar in the morning and the Wiggles in the afternoon and Ringo Starr in the evening. And as long as I didn't mix up the three artists, then I was good, you know. Didn't want to serve as, you know, Ringo Starr to like all the Gwar people. But that's where the variety came in, and I loved it. And but I saw the writing on the wall around 2018, and then just jumped to go and do my own company, and where I'm doing publicity for a lot of the artists that I was working still back then, from Buffy St. Marie to Randy Bachman, 5440, among others. And so it's great, because now it's writing bios, writing press releases, coordinating photo shoots, sometimes organizing whatever the band needs, and then pitching for the media, for the all the dailies, all the weeklies, all the monthly magazines and newspapers, all the blogs, all the Spotify playlisters, all the radio stations across Canada and around the world. So I love it, because no 2 days are ever different. And more importantly, I get to work 18-hour days like I wanted to, like I always did, but on somebody else's clock. You know, now I can work, you know, from like 8 in the morning until 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, and love it. I love it. It's great.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man. I'm sure our audience wants to know, so why don't we put them out of their misery, Eric? I'd love to hear a good Ringo Starr story if you have one.
Yeah, well, you know, I know enough about the Beatles, and I've read enough about interviews with all four of them, that when you're in a room with somebody like Ringo Starr, who at the time there were three of them still alive. George Harrison was still around, and obviously Paul and Ringo. And you just have to know that he knows that you know that you're looking at him as a Beatle. Like, he knows that. And so everything, until you cross the line of the personal friendship, which for Ringo keeps it really close and keeps it really tight. You know, he smells when something is off really, really well. And I think in listening to Paul McCartney's interviews, he knows how to deal with kind of fans in a very lighthearted manner, you know, shake your hand, thumbs aloft, you know, and move on and answer the questions that people want to answer and get really, really deep into it because he wrote the songs. He Sure. wrote the music. With Ringo, I'm not going to call him a bystander because he absolutely wasn't, but his answers are going to be very, very different than, say, Paul McCartney's or John Lennon's or George's. So when I got to work with Ringo, the first it was for the Choose Love album, and I ended up working 5 albums, 3 solo albums and 2 live albums. But the amazing thing about Ringo was that he used to rehearse the All-Star Band up at Rama, Ontario, in Casino Rama, and just north of the city. It's about an hour and a half north of Toronto. And they used to be there for about 2.5 weeks in close quarters, rehearsing for their tour, then kicking off the tour at Rama for a couple of nights, and then going off for the worldwide tour. But one year we actually had, every year before, or every year that they launched it, their tour, they used to have a massive press conference. So Playboy magazine came, Rolling Stone magazine came, a lot of the Canadian media came, obviously. And it was about 150, 200 people that usually come to one of the press conferences. But one year, it was very, very different because a couple of days before, George Martin had either leaked or accidentally spoke about the fact that George Harrison was very, very, very close to passing away. And so it was all anybody wanted to talk about because Paul wasn't ready yet to talk about it, or he didn't want to talk about it. So it was left up to, and Paul McCartney is a guy that you can't get a hold of. Like, if you're in the media, you have to go through so many different hoops, and he does so few media. Here with the first opportunity to get a Beatle to talk about what was going on with George, because it was so long ago, or at the time that a Beatle had passed away, with John Lennon in 1980. But he handled it like a bro, but it was madness because I think we almost doubled or even tripled the size of the press conference. People that would normally not want to be there covering Ringo's tour because they could pick it up from another magazine or another newspaper just to save time and energy and space, went to it because they had a feeling like he was going to be talking about it. But Ringo was Ringo. He, you know, sideswiped anything that he didn't want to talk about. But overall, I mean, one of the nicest, kindest, funniest people you'll ever want to have in the room. You know, there's a story, and I don't know if it's true or not, but there was one year where the All-Star Band was there, and a number of the All-Stars wanted to find their local AA chapter, because while they're on the road, like most people would probably imagine, if you have a drug or an alcohol problem in your past, the worst place you can be is on the road, where Sure. you are just stricken with boredom for 22 hours of the day, and then you get to go and play in front of real live people for 2 hours. So somebody found the local AA chapter, and it was a local priest that was down the road. And one of the people from the inner circle called and said, great, you know, I've got a client. He's going to be there on Tuesday at 7 o'clock. And the priest was like, great. And on his doorstep was something like 4/5 of the All-Star Band. Wow. And so I'm sure that he had some great stories about that. But, you know, for confidentiality, I'm sure that he couldn't go to like the nearest newspaper and say, oh my gosh, look who was in my living room the night before. But those kind of, I mean, the fact that as a kid and even as an adult, look, I was listening to the Beatles when I was 8. I was listening to the Beatles when I was 28. I'm 53. I'm still listening to the Beatles. Was, you just didn't want to screw up, you know? And fear is everything in this industry. You know, fear, you can smell it on artists when they, just before they're performing, they get very anxious and very antsy. I'm the same way. You know, I'm no different for these people. We just have different jobs to do. But that was a real moment. And you know, right behind me is the autographed drum that Ringo signed for the last tour. And, wow. And I will, you know, but stuff like that is makes it all worthwhile for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That's incredible, Eric. I remember the All-Star Band. One of the best performances I've ever seen. It was the year he had, I think it was Sheila E. on drums and the great, one of my favorites, Richard Marx.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he,
Richard is amazing. He's awesome. Have you read his book?
Stories to Tell. I regret. What kind of fan am I? I have not read it yet, but I mean to.
Finish it in 4 days
sure.
You will have so much more love and respect for him. Even if you do love him or respect him, the guy, you know, artists like that tend to sometimes get a little bit of a bad rap in the media because of their success and the kind of music that they play. But I think that if you were to sit down and meet him, there is absolutely nothing bad that you can say about a guy like that who is hysterically funny, who has friends that you would never believe all hanging out. And he writes a perfect pop song. So like, shut up, you know, like have to, you know, so, but yes, it's an excellent book.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Endless Summer Nights might be one of my all-time favorites. I know it's cheesy, but...
No, that's good. Cheesy is fine. You know, if the iPod told us anything, it was like, it was okay to have guilty pleasure that shouldn't even exist anymore. That first album, but Don't Mean Nothing on it is still mind-bogglingly so tight. So tight. I
mean, Don't Mean Nothing, Hold On to the Nights.
Yeah.
Incredible album. So let's see. I'm really curious, Eric, how you became acquainted with Randy Bachman. You know, we talked a little bit for our audience. We talked a little bit before we went on air. I had the pleasure of interviewing his son, Tal, who of course will be known as the guy who did the great song, She's So High.
Yeah.
On my other podcast, I actually had him on twice. How is it that you first met Randy?
So Randy was on a record label called True North Records, which I now work with as well. And they were, and they are Canada's longest running folk roots blues record label. It's home to Randy Bachman and Sue Foley and Colin James and Murray McLaughlin, among others, and Bobby St. Marie. And so I got to work with him probably starting in about 2014 when he was going out on tours and putting together a slew of releases from his catalog and also working a couple of the Guess Who archive releases. He's a guy that you don't really want to talk much around him. You would love to just listen to him talk. He, you know, when you talk about stories, he's a guy that if he was playing in London, England, or had some time off, would probably call George Martin or Giles Martin, now his son, and be able to go into Abbey Road Studios and listen to the isolated tracks of Sgt. Pepper and go on and come home and talk about it on his radio show that you can hear called Vinyl Tap. He has so many amazing stories to tell, and interviewers and the media loved him, because what Randy always understood is that it's not enough to just have a new album or a new song. You have to kind of be able to have your audience relate to it. You know, none of the stuff that you and I read or your audience reads on a daily basis when it comes to music really has anything to do with the music, especially now when we're living in such a time where social media causes stories and gossip to kind of overtake somebody's new release or the meaning behind a song. But Randy always understood that there was, you know, when he's talking about the birth of American Woman, and he tells the story about, you know, somebody breaking a string on stage and him noodling about telling, you know, and just singing about American Woman on stage while it's happening is amazing, because that's the stuff that people want to hear. They want to hear the story behind the hits. And Randy always knew that, growing up with the Beatles and Dave Clark Five and Hermit's Hermits and the Stones, and reading a lot as a kid as well, to know that people were always going to be interested in what, you know, there's a story about on You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, where they were in the studio and somebody called for a pizza, and the pizza delivery guy delivered it about a half hour later and realized that it was Randy Bachman and BCO in the studio, and told him that he plays piano. And Randy was like, yeah, sure, go ahead and you know, show me what you've got. And don't know if this part is true, but that's the piano person that's on Taking Care of Business that he ended up jamming with him for that song. And, you know, depending on who you ask, you know, that story's kind of true or that's not really, but that's the stuff that makes people go, oh yeah, that's a really great song. And then when they hear that song and they hear the piano, they're going to think, oh yeah, that was just a piece of delivery guy, or talking about You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet with that stutter in the chorus. That was Randy taking a dig at his brother when they were younger, because Randy used to make fun of his brother's stuttering like kids do and like brothers do. And sure, it's mean and it's bullying, but that's what you did when you were your kid, when you hated and loved your brother at the same time, is you just made fun of anything that you can do just to bring him down a notch. But You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. The reason why he stutters is because it was a little bit of a nod and a tribute to his brother who used to stutter all the time. So yeah, Randy was great. Randy was always on time. When you booked a 20-minute interview with him, I always had to book an extra 40, you know, an extra 20, 25 minutes on top of that. So the interview thing would be like the interview call sheet would say 11 o'clock to 11:20, you know, 12 o'clock to 12:20. And then Randy would be like, well, what am I going to do for 40 minutes? And I'm like, just trust me on this. And then, of course, he would talk for 55 minutes, giving everybody the best interview that they've ever had. So Randy was great. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's awesome. That's awesome. I didn't know any of that.
I always learned really early on. And I know that, you know, in the last two stories, I've said, you know, I don't know if it's true. You know, somebody once told me, you know, when fact and fiction meet, always publish the fiction.
Yeah. When the myth becomes legend, print the legend, I think was the Liberty Valance thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
How's that for a reference?
Makes a better story, you know? Yeah. I mean, people, publicists back in the 70s and 80s who worked at record labels used to make up just stuff just to keep the press going, you know, and it took me a number of years, but like, I remember sitting down with some of these like former pop idols that I read about in Tiger Beat. And I was like, did this really happen? Like, did you actually fill out that questionnaire? And they were like, I have no idea. They didn't even know any of this stuff every time that they were in the magazine. It was written by other publicists just to keep it, you know, keep that those careers going, feeding the beast and having this never ending cycle of media and gossip and relationships and who's dating who and getting set up just so that they could be seen by photographers. We see it now with the Kardashians and Taylor Swift and everybody else. And, you know, it's very easy to kind of disappear if you wanted to and not have the paparazzi hound you. You just have to have your publicist stop calling the media, letting them know where you are.
Well, it's like, I never quite figure out if this is true or not. I think Michael Jackson planted the hyperbaric chamber story, didn't he?
Yep, sure did.
Okay, I thought he did.
Yep. Yeah, there's so many of the weird ones that you hear about Michael Jackson and everything from the Elephant Man to him buying the bones of the Elephant Man to him sleeping in an oxygen tank were all his. They all came from his people because they just wanted to keep the name out there and to gently pat the head of the quote weird artist who was just zipping on another planet. And it worked.
Yeah, it sure did.
And then he gets to write Leave Me Alone, a song about all of these lies that the gossip media are spreading. And meanwhile, it's all from you. So you get to feed on it three times. So it's great.
I'm really curious, Eric, when did you first meet Ray Charles? What was he like?
Ray Charles was 4 months before his passing away. There was one of the record labels that we were working called Concord Records were going to be releasing his Genius Loves Company album. And we started getting all of these Betamax tapes in the mail from the record label that was Ray Charles and Norah Jones and Ray Charles and this artist and that artist talking about the genius of Ray Charles in order to service the media about the upcoming album, Genius Loves Company. And I went down to Los Angeles and got to hang out with him, talked about his early career, but mostly I was just fascinated by the fact that, you know, when you talk about Ray Charles, it just can't be understated that, you know, this is a guy that literally changed music 3 or 4 times and, you know, mixing R&B and gospel and church music and country music into this rock and roll with the modern sound of album is, I mean, that's why they call him the genius. And, you know, he was a really very laid back, but I got the sense that something was going to be up somewhere down the road more likely sooner than later about his health. Nobody knew that anything was going to be coming down that was ultimately going to be him passing away. But I got to kind of hang out with him for about 45 minutes, an hour or so, and just got to ask him and pepper him with all those questions. But mostly it was about his start and how he kind of created something from nothing. And also just, I think, how he got a little bit of a bad rap in the 80s, where a lot of these artists were selling massive amounts of copies in the R&B and hip hop world and soul world, and not giving any credit to somebody like that. It was really watching, you know, at the time of the 80s and 90s, seeing him perform a couple of times in the U.S. in places that were pretty small, you know, compared to what I think somebody like him should be playing into and the amount of respect and love that he got. So we released the Genius Loves Company album. It was the number one record on the Billboard album chart. It was the number one album in Canada. It was one of the first records to hit number one from an independent record label. And then 3 months after, I think it was somewhere around that time, I'm going to say, I might have this wrong, but I have a feeling he passed away just before the album was released. And then we ended up selling about 300,000 copies in Canada and about 4 million in the US in the first couple of months or so. So that was a real treat to be able to hang out with something like that, because he's a legend, just a legend.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I can only imagine. That's incredible. I'm actually desperate to know how you came to be associated with Sesame Street.
So Sesame Street, yeah. Sesame Street was, there were three artists. When I first got the job offer to go from the small record label to Koch, there was one big reason why I wanted to go there. The first one was I really wanted to work for Smithsonian Folkways, because I was home to Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, among others. And it was my dream to work at that really historical record label, and Koch was distributing it. The second thing that I really wanted to work was I just wanted to work a lot more rock stuff, and they seemingly had it. But the third reason is that they had Sesame Street. And so I thought that was going to be my in to go down to Sesame Street. And sadly, it never was. I never got there. But they would be re-releasing all of their classic 70s albums, like ABC Sing Along and Rubber Ducky and Bob McGrath Sings. They were going to be releasing them for the first time on CD. And so when we launched that, Bob McGrath came up and hung out. And my daughter was 4 at the time. And so we got to hang out, and he was amazing with her. And he was great. And, you know, when you get to be Bob McGrath every day of your life, you have to treat how people are going to treat you as never a burden, because every place you go to from the time from 1970 to the time that Bob McGrath passed away, I'm sure every day somebody came up to him and told him how much they loved watching him on Sesame Street. And when we were at the concert that launched his album and for on CD, normally, you know, it's weird. You know, people like Fred Penner and Bob McGrath and other children performers usually have longer lines at the merch table to meet them than rock stars do, because they meant so much to them, and they helped create them. They helped teach them the ABCs in 1, 2, 3 and taught them manners and taught them all the things that I think more people in this world should be doing, you know, kindness and respect. And the first time you hear about those things is when you're watching Sesame Street or Electric Company and all those shows that. So we got to work all of the albums, and I have about, I don't know, I have about maybe 150 gold and platinum albums in the house. There's one that was hanging on the wall for the longest time until I got it painted in the basement office. And it was Sesame Street's Greatest Hits. And it would be a reminder to me during those really awful times of work, because they do sometimes happen, as much as I love my job and everything like that, to look around to that gold and platinum album and just take a deep breath and say, this is not how the people from Sesame Street would want you to react. And, but yeah, ended up working about 20, 25 albums for them. But it was amazing servicing radio with those songs, getting Morning Zoo radio station that play like rock music or CHR to go on their Friday night mix show and just throw in like the Rubber Ducky song or C is for Cookie when they're playing Guar or when they're playing something, and see if people notice the difference of it. Getting, you know, there was a rave song during the key moments of the rave movement in the early 2000s where somebody, and I can't forget who it was, it's just like a one-hit wonder DJ, did a techno mix of the Sesame Street theme song, and it blew up on the DJ charts around the world. And I remember like telling the people from Sesame Street, like, this is massive. And so they were like, good, you know, service the rest of the album, see what else that they can do. So I never got to them, but throughout the years, every time that they had Sesame Street on Ice, Sesame Street Live, I would always go down and talk with the puppeteers and talk with the people that were there. And they were never the original cast. But that was a real cool moment, because it's almost like you have to treat the Sesame Street albums as the same way, morbidly, as somebody dying and you have to work their future album, because they're not available for interviews.
Right.
And when something big happens, like Kermit is going to co-host the Oscars or do a segment, that was your moment to like go and redo a press release and service those albums again and work those albums again and try to get Sesame Street's name back in the news. And but that was a wild moment. It was, and I know, you know, working for a distributor, when you work that many albums a month, and I'm talking anywhere between 300 to 500 albums, and you're working it to the retail environment, they're looking at very different things than I am when they do their pitches to the person on the other end of the phone or on the other end of the meeting. With retail, you're talking about past sales. You're talking about what kind of budget you have for marketing or advertising. What kind of, where are you placing ads? Are you going to do it in National Geographic Kids? What's the buy-in to this? If you buy 5,000 copies of this album at Toys R Us, we'll put your logo at the bottom of the ad that says available at blah, blah, blah. Hmm. With me, working the media, it's like, I've got Bob McGrath available. Do you want to talk to him? So that kind of stuff was like, I'll send out 500 pitches and I'll get 499 of them back saying, absolutely. Who wouldn't want to talk to him? And then when Sesame Street was doing their live show, it was about inviting all the kids in the media to come down, like the kids of the people who were working in the media. And it wasn't really about, you know, great, now we want to see a review. It was always about, it's such my pleasure to get you guys on the guest list and have fun, because I'm going to do the same. I'm going to get on that guest list too. And we're going to have a party. So those kind of publicity angles and those kind of publicity pitches have I ever asked somebody to do a review or an interview. It's always like, hey, this person is available in case if you want them. It was never about putting them on the spot, and very, very laid back, because I kind of, it's not that I knew, and it's not like that I figured out, and it's not like that it was a marketing initiative going on in my head, but it was mostly about, if you don't ask for something and you just offer it because you love to be doing this, you'll get the stories. you know, and that's why I could never be a publicist that's, you know, in New York that's asked for covers, or that they're saying that it has to be this way or that way or that way. It just wasn't my scene, and I wasn't very good at it. Because I never liked the hard sell of anything. I just kind of wanted to let them know that they were available. They know the media knows their job. They know what to do. They know who these people are for the most part. And if they don't know the artist, then it's kind of my job to come up with three or four stories. But, you know, I want to be the easiest person that they ever have to deal with that day. And Sesame Street was absolutely at the top of the easiest things to work.
I love that, man. Thank you, Eric. That's awesome. Your website points out that you're a 16-time Juno Award winner. I'm curious, how did you win? What's the Juno experience like? How did you win your first Juno, and what was that experience like?
You know, when you're working an album that has been nominated, and the Grammys are like this, and the Brit Awards are like this, when they announce the nominations around February or March for the May show, every one of the five nominees are equal. So a lot of the nominees that are in the Indigenous music category, the folk album of the year, the blues album of the year, classical album of the year, those kind of fringy categories that they give out the awards the night before at a gala dinner that are hardly ever, ever televised. It's amazing that you get to be equal no matter how big or how small you are with all the rest of the members in that category. So forever, you will ever be known as Juno nominated. So my pitches are always, if once you get the nomination for a Juno Award or for a Grammy, it's always Juno nominated, blah, blah, blah. And that's the first thing, because it reveals that you are one of the top five of that year of the album category. So for a lot of new artists, that this might have been their first album or their second album, it's wild because it's their first time on the red carpet. It's the first time getting bombarded by 160 media outlets in less than 20 minutes when they do that red carpet. And it's really special to see that year after year, every time that I'm working an album that is nominated, that it's reliving that experience all over again, and that level of excitement to see all of my colleagues and all my friends and all the people who work in the media and industry to be there together to help support the Canadian music scene. And then when they win, it's amazing because they never can take that away from you. So yeah, I've been lucky enough to work. Colin James has won a bunch. Sue Foley has won a bunch. Bruce Coburn, Buffy St. Marie. And I've worked six of the last seven winners of the Blues Album of the Year category, a slew of folk in the last number of years, but it's wild, and it's something that I don't take for granted. And I know it's something that the artists don't ever take for granted either.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thanks, Eric. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, we've only covered really a snippet of the artists that you've worked with. I'm curious if there's ever been a particular artist that you were just starstruck by. You couldn't believe you were in the same room as him or her.
Oh yeah. Oh, Bob Geldof, hands down. Oh, Bob. I mean, look, Bob Geldof was a guy. I mean, look, most of these artists that I've worked with have changed my life in one form or another, you know, as a kid and as a teenager. Bob Geldof was somebody that I bought, I think, five copies of Do They Know It's Christmas so I can help the cause of Africa. it was the first time I really in my lifetime saw in living form something political going on in music. I mean, I read about what was going on obviously for 50 or 60 years before then, but this was the first time that I saw it and I understood it. And I saw the cast of characters and the people involved with making a benefit record like Do They Know It's Christmas, and then getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, watching Live Aid and loving every single of the performers. That was, you know, Duran Duran and Midge Ure and Mick Jagger and Sting and Phil Collins and Queen. I mean, those are all the, you know, Thompson Twins, Madonna, like those.
David Bowie.
Bowie. It was everybody. Paul McCartney. Everybody. And, you know, back in 1985, that was it. That, you know, the biggest artist in the world. So when I got to work Bob Geldof's Age Sex Death album, I got to pick him up from the airport. He was going to be doing a number of shows as a solo artist. I picked him up from the airport, and the only thing that crossed my mind was, A, here he is. B, don't screw up. And C, don't get into a car accident with him, because then the world's headlines are going to be Bob Geldof gets in a car accident with his idiotic, stupid publicist, you know? So I think I drove very, very carefully. He is the tallest artist I've ever worked. I think he's 6'6" or 6'7".
Oh,
I'm I'm 5 feet tall. I'm 5'9" if I spike up my hair. So together, I think I reach his knees.
You look like his nephew.
I look like his child. You know, he was one of the smartest guys that I've ever worked. And this was after, this is, you know, a couple of years after, obviously with Live Aid and Band Aid, but it was around the time when the anniversary started to pop up, whether it was the 10th anniversary or 15th anniversary of Live Aid, and charitable angles were starting to get a little bit criticized in the major newspapers because some of the money, it was claimed, did not go to where it's supposed to go, which is the biggest knock against any charitable organization, just because of administrative costs, but because of government bureaucrats or government corruption or what have you. He had no problem turning a 5 minute answer, question answer into a 45 minute history of a country, of a culture, of how things operate. This is a man who didn't suffer fools gladly, but it was amazing because he treated everybody with such kindness, because a lot of people didn't know before, you know, the age of Wikipedia, unless you kind of did your research, was that he kind of got his start in music in Canada when he was based in Vancouver writing music for the Georgia Strait weekly newspaper there. So a lot of his entrance into the pop world, into the rock world, and seeing these artists and covering them for the very first time was right here in Canada. So he had immense love for this country, and this country loved him back. But he was somebody that I just looked at, and I couldn't believe that if you were to tell me as a 15-year-old that I would be hanging out with him for about 5 or 6 days, I would have never, ever believed it. But, you know, those are the same people. Everybody is super nice. You know, that's the biggest question I think that I always get asked is, you know, what's Sinead O'Connor like? She is amazingly nice. She is kind, you know. I think part of it, and no knock to Americans whatsoever, but part of it is that they're in Canada. You know, it's a lot more laid back. The audiences are a lot more laid back. I think that they appreciate you as an artist coming to Canada, because it's so easy to call your, you know, you're going to do a North American tour and then do, you know, one show in Toronto and that's it, you know? So when you play Montreal, people love you for that. When you play Halifax, people love you. Vancouver, when you're playing Minneapolis and you skip up north to go and play in Winnipeg, people love that. And I think that it's a lot less hustle. It's a lot less, you know, stress relief. And I think that's probably going back to full circle. It's exactly, I think, why Ringo Starr did the rehearsals at Casino Rama, was because it was away from Las Vegas. It was away from New York. And as much as they love those people, they needed to work. It's why the Stones continue to rehearse for their world tours right here in Toronto, because we just don't harass them when they're walking down the street as much as everybody else would.
Right, right. That makes sense to me. No, I think if there was one artist that I would really love to meet or write with or whatever, it would probably have to be Richard Marx. I'm curious if there's a particular artist that you wish you could work with that you haven't been able to for whatever reason.
Phil Collins. Just, you know, there, before that answer, I mean, there's probably three really quick. Tears for Fears, because I love them. And I got to meet and work with both of them. Did some PR for some of their Canadian dates when they were out at Tears for Fears. And then got to work Kurt Smith's last album before he got together with Roland again for this album. And that was one where I got to pepper him with every fan question I can possibly think of. And then when I got my radio show on Sirius XM, I just got to ask them again, which was great. So Tears for Fears, loved working with them and wish I could work with them more. Talk Talk is another band that I love. I wish that I got to meet and hang out and work with Mark Hollis, the lead singer, but unfortunately he passed away. I still listen to all of their albums on almost a weekly, if not twice every 2 weeks basis, whenever I'm working on grind work that I need to do. But the one artist at the top of my list that I've never talked to, I've never had on my show. I've never worked. I've only been in the same room with him, along with 18,000 other people at a concert, would be Phil Collins. And my daughter has developed a cool little relationship with his daughter, Lily. And my ringtone is the drum beat, is the drum roll for In the Air Tonight. And when they met, I was there and I met Jill, his ex-wife, Lily's mother. I had the biggest fear come over me and my face just dropped because I realized that, you know, while I'm here kind of playing it cool, and they both know that I was a fan. My daughter had told them both, like, he's a super fan. Like, he knows more about your dad than you do. my biggest fear was like somebody was going to call me and my ringtone was going to go up and that was going to be the end of it. It was, but it, you know, I safely put it on silence. Read his book. He knew probably every other story in there, but he is somebody that I would have, I don't, you know, it's funny. And I think you might be the same way. Phil Collins is an artist that if I ever got a chance to do an interview with, I'm not sure I can actually come up with some interesting questions because I wouldn't know what to ask, knowing that it's, I'm not here to talk to them for me. I'm there for the listener. I would not know where to go. I wouldn't even know how to begin that conversation of, I love you. And now that that's over and done with.
It was nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you. Like, thanks for showing your face.
Yeah.
Because there are so many minute details of somebody's life that you know, and you don't, I don't know if it would be important for somebody to know and put it in context.
Well, it's like, yeah, I know what you mean. It's like, if I ever had the pleasure of interviewing Richard Marx, why don't I just, I'll just continue my Richard Marx fetish here. Yeah. I think, what could I really ask him? I suppose we talk about songwriting craft because he's got a lot to say there. What do you think makes a hit?
Yeah.
You know, and I'd probably see if I can squeeze a song out of him.
Yeah. Song Exploder, the podcast, had a really great idea of going deep into one song. And I love that kind of stuff. And not to give any plugs to any other podcast, because this is the only podcast that anybody should matter. But the reason why I bring it up is because if you were to corner somebody like you or I into an interview and go deep and really structure something, focusing on one song would be the way to go.
Absolutely.
And when I do my radio show, I'm coming at it as a publicist. I'm coming at it from a fan. I mention people I work with that I have on the show or, hey, I worked with that person that you just dropped, only because it kind of gives me a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit of an in to, I know what you're talking about from a business perspective, or at least from like how the industry works. So I'm not coming at it from a gossip, and they know that it's a really safe space. So I've no desire to be to get them on TMZ, and that's not what the show is about. But the ability to, you know, my favorite interviews are the ones where it's like an anniversary of an album, or that I had Martin Fry from ABC on a couple of weeks ago, and all I really wanted to talk about. So ABC is a band from the 80s. They had a huge debut album called The Lexicon of Love with The Look of Love on it and Poison Arrow. Their second album called Beauty Stab was absolutely trashed by the media. They went from, you know, this new romantic to a little bit glam and rock, and the critics just slammed and hated that record. Still to this day, when you reach and when you read the worst albums of all time or the worst follow-ups of all time, that album, Beauty Stab, is absolutely going to make their list. I loved it. I loved that record to death. I still have the cassette. I bought it on CD. I still have it on my playlist. It's the number one song. That was then, this is now, on my running playlist when I ran the marathon for the very first time. So I got to talk about that album.
That's awesome. Him.
So now those kind of interviews are like, look, I can ask you about the Lexicon of Love. I can ask about, are you really a romantic? Are, you know, I can ask about Martin's cancer that he had just before he was all, before the band was going to be set to go out and headline with Tina Turner and literally change their lives overnight. I mean, they were already big, But this was going to be bigger than Duran Duran because that tour was going to be putting them in front of 70,000 people a night for months and months and months and months and months. And Martin Fraser, the lead singer, got canceled, got cancer, had to drop off the tour, and their career were never the same again. Still really great, still had a lot of hits, but not, you know, and so he came out and talked about that cancer stuff. So I could have just had him rehash everything all over again, but I didn't want to because I thought, what am I going to ask him about that? Like, I don't know. Like, I've just read about his cancer. I'm going to assume that everybody else that's listening to this interview has already had. So I'm going to ask him about beauty stuff. So we just talked about 20 minutes about an album that seemingly nobody in the audience is ever going to have in their collection. But maybe they got another couple hundred streams because of it. Those are my favorite interviews because I know what it's like. And this is going to sound awful. I know what it's like when you're an artist answering the same questions over and over and over and over again when you're promoting an album or a video or a tour. And that's okay. They're doing their job. That they should be asking about that stuff. And they're really good ones like Randy Bachman, like Bob Geldof, like Sinead O'Connor, always have different answers for the same question. And they treat you like it's the first time that they've heard it. So they're pros. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the 16th interview that they're doing that day asking about. So I get to ask them about the one album that nobody has probably heard, not to be a geek or not to show off my knowledge. It's probably mostly because I love that record and nobody else does. And I don't want to talk about really anything else. Cause so back to Phil Collins, what on earth am I going to ask him about being on the Concord for Live Aid? How big No Jacket Required was, how he came up with the sound, that gated reverb sound of the drum. No, there's 75 videos that can tell you all about that. I'm going to ask him, don't know. See, I don't know. I don't know what I would ask him. I'd ask him what he would have for lunch. I don't know. But I love to ask people, and I'm all, even during the downtime, you know, talking about stories. I want to know what it's like life in the middle of that hurricane. I want to know not necessarily how they wrote that song, because a lot of them are just going to say it's magic or hear the inspiration. That's all really cool. I want to know what it's like when you can't go outside anymore and be bombarded. I want to know what that does to your psyche. I want to know what that does to your mental health, because it's a status that very few people that have been born on this planet has ever achieved in their lifetime.
Right.
And when we're talking about mental health, which is a big topic, obviously, with being famous and TikTok and Spotify and all of the rest of the stuff and inflation and what it's like to be an artist, the mental health aspect of becoming famous very, very quickly is one that fascinates me to no end. And it's almost like I'm more curious to know what happens when you start to go down off of that molehill or off that mountain, because that's when you realize how awful, evil, corrupt, and all the really bad things that this industry could be when people stop returning your phone call. That's what I want to know, because that to me tells more about a person, how they reacted to something like that than not, you know? So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well said. Can't let this go, because you mentioned Tears for Fears. Woman in Chains is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Yeah, what a great song.
I don't know if you listened to the Kurt Nielsen Espen Lind cover.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. I cannot believe that it's live.
See? So I want to know, and you know, my geeky, peppery fan question to Kurt Smith was like, tell me, like, walk me through like 8 years of putting together The Siege of Love. Because I got to ask him about, what was that sound on Songs from the Big Chair? Like, how did you come up with a song like Listen when like it's a, or what's the last line of like Mad World? Like, what is that? You know? And so those were all like, well, this is really what it means. And this is what people think it means. But I want to know what it's like for 8 years when you're struggling to put together a record, you have more money in the bank than you've ever seen in your life. And you just don't know what a good idea is anymore. You know, half your brain is saying, yes, let's do this guitar part backwards. And the other part of it is like, you're an idiot. This would never work. And start erasing the tapes. That's the fascinating thing to me, because more than anything else, I can't play a note. I can't sing. I can't play guitar. I can't play drums. I've attempted to do all three and I suck. So what they do is sheer magic to me. And I want to know what it's like when you're watching the clock and your worst song that you have recorded from this album becomes the biggest song of your career. I want to know what it's like when you are just, you know, you get to be like U2 and you are so stressing out over When the Streets Have No Name and you are so angry and so mad and so frustrated with all these charts that Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois have around the studio like a mad mathematician. And you are so upset that Brian Eno wants to delete the tapes and literally change the way that the Joshua Tree is going to be heard forevermore. I want to know what that's like, you know? So, you know, the art of songwriting, amazing. I you know, there's people that would know tones and notes and how you came up with this. And when you're talking to somebody like Joe Satriani, who I've worked with for a lot of years, I can't ask him about what it's different guitars because I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I have no idea. That's a cool red guitar. And he's like, yes, this is a, you know, I don't know, in one ear and out the other ear, you know? So when I talk to somebody like Gene Simmons, when he launches his new bass guitar, I have to ask him, like, okay, so tell me what's the difference between that guitar and the one that you just had? Like, and then he gets into the minute details of the tone and the sound and the strings and the notes, stuff like that. Cool. I think I get it. I don't get it. Maybe the fans get it. But now what I want to know is, like, how you get Gene Simmons to say yes to doing something like this when you have 15,000 licensed product, but you have 150,000 pitches. What does it take to say yes to that?
Right.
You know, goes back into the psyche thing of everything. So yeah, that's the stuff I want to know.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I just got two questions left, Eric. Then
I'm going to answer them really quick.
No. I'm on your time. I really appreciate it. I just noticed that we're over time. I want to be respectful of yours. So Eric, you've been interviewed many times by people, I assume, better looking than me.
I mean,
has there ever been a question that hasn't been asked of you that you wish someone would ask?
No. I think I've covered my whole boring life in one form or another. You know, I mean, don't forget, like, I'm a publicist. I'm not supposed to be the one doing media. I'm not supposed to be the one having a million followers on social media. That
right.
is all just happenstance and luck and people just like being bored and loving some things of what I post and hating others. So none of this is supposed to happen. I'm never supposed to be talking to you. I'm the publicist, usually just stay in the background. So it's always a weird scenario to talk about yourself in the way, because people in the industry aren't really supposed to be known for the most part of it, except in like Billboard magazine or the trade publication. I just happen to be lucky enough to be able to walk that fine line, knock on wood, of like being able to talk about the industry while being in it. And so I don't think that there's anything I'm desperate to get out. I love my dogs. I've never been asked about my dogs. No, I'm only kidding. I think I have been asked about it.
Good stuff. Well, if you weren't a music publicist, Eric, what do you think you'd be in life?
You know, this is going to sound like such a cop out, but I have absolutely no idea. This is the only job I've ever wanted to do once I realized that it existed when I was 13 and 12 years old, and I couldn't think of anything else. I loved telling stories. I loved hearing stories. I loved being around people who shared music. I would love to be the backup drummer for Phil Collins, but that's not going to happen. Thanks, Nick, to his son. But I really don't know. I don't know what else I think I would be really good at or comfortable with. I love what I do. I'm going to be doing this until the day I die. You know, I'm going to be doing this until I don't care what the next social media company that blows out. I don't care if there's going to be chips in our brains that we're not going to have a use for Spotify. I don't care what the new number of the phones are going to be or how people are going to be consuming music. I just want people to continue to consume music, and I will be right there sharing it with the media or whoever else wants to listen.
Beautiful. I love it, Eric. Eric Alper, how can people find out about you, sir?
They can find me online at that Eric Alper or visit the website anytime at thatericalper.com.
Awesome. And you have a radio show too, right?
Yeah, I have a radio show on Sirius XM where it's just kind of like this, just people hanging out. It's on Sirius XM, channel 167, or on the app anytime. It is called At That Eric Alper, and I talk to 4 musicians a week and just hang out with them, which is great. The best part of doing what I do.
Fantastic. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time for me, man. This was a blast.
I love talking to you, Josh. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it very much, man. You take care.
You too. Thanks, man.
All right. Bye, Eric.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.